When you went over to France, how did you find the quality of the food was when you got there?
It was adequate, and but not very varied. The basic ration was a pound of meat, which was or three-quarters of a pound of bully beef. The meat was almost always in the form of stew in position places where you could cook it, and of course the bully beef was in perhaps forward posts and trenches where you couldn't do any cooking. Bread as a rule, alternatively pretty hard ration biscuit, butter, jam, tea, sugar.
And did you manage to get your supplies pretty regularly throughout
yes,
the war?
Yes, they came very well indeed. Of course, in the forward areas, they had to be carried up by ration parties. It was quite a business because you had your transport lines well out of the line. And then every night, the ration parties came up. The transport was horse-drawn, what they called limbered wagons. And your rations were made up by company units. And they came up with a quartermaster sergeant of the companies to some dispersal point from which they had to be cared for by carrying parties every night. And but they always arrived, and they were made up in advance according to the subunits they were going to. So you've got a sandbag containing the rations for so many men, that sort of thing.
Did you find that the quantity and the quality and the regularity of the food would vary between being in the front line as against being in the rear areas?
Oh yes, because in rear areas you've got other things. You've got fresh meat and vegetables and that sort of thing, which perhaps couldn't be produced. But on the other hand, the front line, you've probably got things called McConachy rations, which are sort of rather like a made-up stew in a tin, which were popular. We had a variety of tin foods you have today. It's a rather new idea, producing tin milk, of course. It was otherwise, it was usually some sort of stew made up by the troops in their own cans, their own canteens, and tea which was brewed, and usually an issue of rum, which you usually served after the night's work with a cup of tea of cocoa before chaps had a chance to get down and who were not on duty could get down and get some rest. And jolly good cocoa with a little rum in it is when you come in after a cold night's work.
That rum was a regular feature both in and out the front line, was it?
I can't remember whether they got it out of the line. I think not. We always got it in the line. Mm.
Did
one of the great griefs of my life is that in the final attack in which I took part, we got orders after we captured an objective out in the day. And we were suddenly summoned to battalion headquarters, which had, of course, moved up at about 10 o'clock at night and told that rumour was the Germans were pulling out. And we were to continue the advance at 5 in the morning. We had to move forward with covered by patrols about 3 miles in the dark to our start line, which was merely a road taken off the map. And some great difficulty, we managed to get our people onto the start line just about as the barrage opened, still carrying our rum, which we intended to issue on the start line, unless there it is to this day, as far as I'm concerned. Somehow I think the following troops managed to mop it up.
Did you find that the food varied at any stage of the war? For example, did it become less regular or less good later on in the war?
I don't think there was very much difference from the point of view of the rations of the troops. Mm. Officers in those days were perhaps so lucky. We had a mess staff, your officer's mess staff, and normally, and we had a little mess cart, which was everything's horse-drawn. We used to send him off down to a place quite a long way. I used to buy fresh fish and things like that. But that was really to supplement the officers from out of their own pockets, but the men, all we could supplement is what we could buy from the canteen out of our such regimental funds we could raise.
I see.
But on the whole, the standard ration, which we all fought when the war used when the war was actually in progress, so the operation, the actual operation in progress, was adequate. We had a lot of latterly of things like beans with a bit of imaginary bacon. There was great excitement when someone found a bit of real bacon in the tin of beans, you know, and that sort of thing. But it was all right.
Did you...
Plum and apple jam got rather notorious because we had so much of it.
I see. Did you find that... how did you find the... From your periods of home leave during the war, the amount of food that the civilians had access to compared with the regularity of supplies for soldiers on the war front?
Well, of course it was rationed, and but I can't remember that so well because I had very little home leave because I was never really long enough. I was home for a week, I think, in after being in hospital in 1918, and I had sick leave after being in hospital on other occasions, but it was generally, I would say, not under the same pressure as in World War II or, or just after World War II.
Did you find that rest and leave periods were regularly came around when you were fighting on the Western Front?
When we were holding a sector, as in 1916, the 14th Court, which we belonged, were given the task of holding the left flank of the army while they were building up for some battle upon a year. And then it became very much a routine, really. And we roughly did about 14 days in the line, of which probably half was actually in the very front line in a reserve unit area. And then we pulled right out to a rest camp or behind, about 5 or 6 miles behind, where we had complete change and did a little bit of cleaning up and minor training, that sort of thing, just for 4 days, and then back into line again. And one of the features, which may not have been mentioned to any other people, was when we were, the camps in the East End were a long way back, reliefs were carried out by train. Did you know that? A train was run up every night, marvellously driven. The drivers were all awarded, and they ran up the Menin Road, really, which was a light railway, right up to just behind Ypres, where your troops were carried up in the train. And, of course, the road was shelled every night, and this chap was very clever in spotting a shelling, stopping a train, running up absolutely silently, and that the Germans must have known it was going on, but the troops went up that way frequently.
As indeed did
all the transport from massive units who had to go through the bottleneck of Ypres itself, the Menin Gate being the only way of getting through, up this one road, the Menin Road.
This 14 days in, 14 days out, was that...
Not 14 days out, about 4 or 5 days out.
14 days in, 4 or 5 out. Was this the regular pattern throughout your period on the Western Front, or are you talking about this one specific period at the end of 1915?
When you were in a static area, that was more or less roughly what happened.
Yeah.
But, of course, when you went down to mobile operations, it just depended. You went into an operation... you probably moved into the forward area on X day. The operation probably took part on X plus 2 or X plus 3. Then went on as far as you were able to, which may have been for X plus 4 or 5, and then were relieved and went back a bit.
I see.
I mean, but the rate of casualties, of course, by that time, it's usually rather necessary.
And during these static periods, how regularly did you get home leave?
I think it was running about once in 6 to 9 months. I literally never quite qualified because I was most I ever did continuously in France for 6 months.
I see. When you were in the front line, what kind of things did you do for recreation and personal entertainment?
Well, in the front line, there's nothing much you could do because you were working all night. You were very glad to sleep when you could in the daytime. There are a lot of duties to be done, going round posts and seeing to weapons and inspecting certain things like men's feet to see they're being properly cared for and boots and seeing that trenches are organised and kept sanitary and all this kind of thing. You had to live in these places. And your daily routine, but otherwise you just read, if you were such books or magazines or things people sent you. And by that time you found that it was time for your next duty, whatever it was. Mm. You had very little spare time, really. Mm. But when you were out of the line,
yes,
we did try and organise games, football, and we did on one occasion play one or two games of cricket. When we were out for one length of time, the whole division, the division organised divisional sports and horse show, in which we did rather well, I remember. And particularly our transport won a lot of prizes. We had a very good transport organisation, and they were all horsed, of course, and they did rather well in that. And those kind of recreations. And there was the 6th Division, which we were serving most of the time, had its own concert party made up of drawn troops in the division called the 6th Division All Fancies. And they were amusing, and troops probably out of the time, they was trying to arrange yet that the fancies came and played them when they were out in periods of rest and that sort of thing.
What kind of things would they put on?
Oh, musical stuff. But cherry and gay and topical songs and all that kind of thing, and troops could join in and so on. Topical jokes and all that kind of thing. I don't remember the details now, but I remember very well, they were great fun.
You've mentioned that during the static periods in the front line, there really wasn't much you could do in the way of entertainment because you were too busy. What were you too busy doing?
In the front line?
Yes.
Well,
what was the routine?
Starting, at night, because everything began, you couldn't do much movement in most sectors. Except at night, in the Somme, where you had deep communication trenches, you could move about a bit, because you would cut in the chalk there. But in the way we had built up breastworks, there was very little movement in daytime at all. The moment is dark enough, having organised various duties beforehand, some people to work on the barbed wire, others to improve bits of breastwork or communication trench being blown in during the day, laying new duck balls, improving draining, carrying parties for tools and ammunition and grenades and all this kind of thing, and rations. Having got this all organised, my sort of crawling about in the daytime, and the moment it was dark enough, everybody got cracking on their jobs. And they went on until probably about, according to how busy they were, about 12, 2 in the morning, and some riding patrol and so on. Then gradually they was drawn back and were given something hot to drink, and were able, those off duty, which is about a third, were on duty always, to doss down in little such funk holes as they'd be able to make in the front line, usually little sort of shelter from the rain, really. And then the moment it was daylight again, you managed to get some sort of breakfast round to the chaps around you. Chaps had time to write letters, and but there's always something to be done, particularly the inspection. So much inspecting had to be done to see keeping things that were in working order, that even weapons had to be seen to a lot, you know, living in mud. It takes a very long time to get a weapon clean after the counterattack on the assailant in 1916. Although I wasn't actually with it, I was at the transport line, I only arrived that night. I saw the weapons when they came out. They were most of them so jammed with mud, you could hardly recognise them at all. I saw what I thought was a great lump of wood lying outside some company hut, and discovered it was a loaded Lewis gun, absolutely caked in mud. Mm. Well, you see, all that has to be kept very, it must be kept working, or otherwise it wouldn't work at all.
During these static periods, in your experience, how frequent a part did trench raids play in these night duties?
very variable, depending very much on the part of the world you were, how far you were from the Germans, for instance, down in the south. The distance apart was very up to about 1,500 yards sometimes. Where in the north, you were literally, they were just a few yards away, almost, not quite, from grenade-bombing distance. And so that you only use patrols when you want to get some particular information or knowledge or for protective duties. I think it was in the north, there was really very little opportunity of sending patrols that could penetrate right through. And I'd say, what to give them a task to do, and we knew enough about what was happening, they would do the same as we were. They want to do is to keep a quiet sector quiet, really, rather than stir it up.
Did they?
I thought
it was part of the policy of the British, and in this sense was in contrast to French military policy, that one tried to keep up a continual activity by trench raids and such like matters, just for the purpose of keeping the Germans occupied and not allowing them to rest.
Well, up to a point, that's true. A trench raid took a lot of organization. And, for instance, even if you put over a small party, it must have a purpose. It usually was to obtain identifications, let's say, to find out who the troops were. It was expected to be a relief from the formation opposite you. You want to find out what the new formation was, or they got new weapons that were being installed, or something of that sort. Then they organized a raid to try and secure information on their subjects. That required a very elaborate plan. It included probably intense box barrage of artillery, very carefully timed, and a lot of training behind of the men to take part, who probably were trained entirely over a reconstructed model of the whole thing. And all that takes an awful lot of time. And actually do it. They dug it on the ground, worked it out, and the timing and everything. Maybe it's gaining success. That's the way they all worked. And so, I actually didn't take part in any trench raid joint time out there.